changed him, he who cared for nothing but himself, who acted on fleeting impulse. Peter Sell, who owned the boat, called to his son,
Alec, take the rudder. I go talk a little to that Aaron Sell who come back.
He came up and stood beside Aaron for a few minutes, looking east, said cautiously,
So you are back here. You are older.
Yes, I am older. As are you.
I heard that sad news about Ginot. Very sad.
What sad news?
He looked at Peter.
Etienne didn't find you?
That Joe Dog didn't find you?
Nobody found me. I've been to sea on the ships. Years. I just come back now.
Joe Dog from the Axe Factory?
What was he doing here?
Looking for you. That Mr. Bone never come back, so Joe Dog wants to go find out what happened. He wants you to go with him, look for you in Boston but never find you. So he come here. Etienne said to him, I will go. I will find Ginot. They go to New Zealand, very damn far. When they come back, Etienne and Joe Dog look for you again in Boston. Then Etienne come back here and said maybe Joe Dog finds you.
He did not find me. What happened?
Aaron knew, of course, with that much searching and travel, that Ginot had to be dead.
I only know Etienne said Ginot died with bad sickness in that sore leg. Mr. Bone dead, too, by a man in grass clothes.
There was a long silence. Aaron looked at the horizon. He felt an interior ripping as though something was pulling at his lungs. He forced a breath, looked at Peter Sell. He said,
The death of my father does not surprise me. He went away so many years ago. I grieve. I wish I had gone with him. I was a bad and stupid person before. Maybe I still am that person, but I think I am different.
A man can get better, said Peter Sell.
They stood silent while the sails filled and the boat took its course east.
Alec is my son.
He is a good sailor, said Aaron.
He is. He has 11 winters, but he knows the boat. And the water.
There was a long silence, then Peter said,
Sometimes good men start out very bad. I was bad like that. Wait when we dock. We can talk a little.
It was dusk when Peter's boat came alongside the wharf and the basket women raced ashore with their goods and money and started the long trek home. Aaron did not follow them but waited. After some minutes, Peter was there, lit his pipe, leaned on the rail. His son Alec coiled a rope a few feet away.
You say you are changed, Peter said. I too changed. Used to drink rum and wine, whiskey, all them poison stuff. Drink and fight. Fight, every night, every day. I didn't have no boat then. I kill a man. Fight him very hard, drunk. Smash his head. I try to break my own head, just get headache. If I still live, I got the change.
Alec came closer, listened, gazing at his father. Aaron wondered if Peter had ever told him this story. It seemed not. After some minutes, Aaron said,
Does Kunta still live?
Yes. He has too many winters now to count. There are not enough numbers for his winters. But he is my father, and he is still very wise and leads us. He no longer hunts, but tells stories of hunting.
Let us go to Kunta and Etienne and the others. I want Etienne to tell me everything about the death of my father, and I have much to tell them.
You go ahead. We come later, said Peter.
He put his hand on his son's shoulder.
Alec and me gotta finish clean the boat. Take care of the boat. Boat take care of you. Me and Etienne and Alec go out early morning catch fish for our celebrate. You want to come fish?
I do. I want this work. I help with the boat, too.
Old Kunta, half asleep in the pre-dawn pallid darkness when Aaron came into his wigwam, woke and stared, listened with mouth agape, put his hands up to his face, and made a sound like a hurt moose.
Come here, he said, stretching out his stringy arms. Come and be embraced by one whose blood is running in circles with happiness. Call everyone, he said to his wife Maudie, who was fumbling with the hide door. Call everyone. Here is a Mi'kmaq son come home. Prepare food. Tomorrow we make a celebration. We will be happy.
The next day, Maudie built up her fire on the riverbank and dragged out her big cooking pots. In late morning, Alec came carrying 3 big mackerel, Etienne and Peter following with more of the huge fat fish. Etienne embraced Aaron. The basket-making women Aaron had seen on the dock came from their wigwams to help make the feast. Aaron sat next to old Kuntaw and tried to explain that he had changed, but the old man waved his hand as if driving off flies.
I know how it is, he said. I have felt this. Look you.
He took up an empty wooden bowl, put in a dipper of water, asked Maudie to bring a dipper of mackerel oil from the pot and added it. He stirred the water and oil briskly with a forked twig until it whirled into an amalgam of froth.
Water is white man. Oil is Mi'kmaq. In the bowl is mix-up métis, he said. White man and Mi'kmaq. Now watch.
They all stared at the bowl. The glistening mackerel oil rose and floated on top of the water.
That's how it was with me long ago. I tried to be white man, but Mi'kmaq oil in me come to top. That same oil come up in you. Sometime I hope for this Canada that the Mi'kmaq oil will blend with the water and oil come to the top. We will hold our country again someday, he said. But we will be a little changed, a little bit watery, and the white men be a little bit oily.
Aaron and Etienne walked away some distance and sat on the ground, drawing strength from contact with the earth. Etienne said,
We look you in Boston, never find.
Aaron said, When I was here before, I saw that old Kuntaw and the cells thought they were making a Mi'kmaq place again, but I did not understand. It felt unsure, as when you take a cup of tea and put it to your mouth and find that what looked to be tea was only the shadow in the cup.
Do you feel this now? Asked Etienne.
No. I drink the shadow now. I find it good.
They passed around the traditional talking stick all day and into the next night before voices slowed and they began to name problems. Food. Lost territory. The cruelty of white men's laws. The loss of good canoe makers. Suddenly, Kuntaw's young wife Maudie, very pregnant, who had been listening, said,
You men are foolish. You do not see the greatest problem of all. We need women here.
There was silence for a minute, and then Etienne said,
She is right. We need more women. I thought they would come if we made a good place, but they have not come. Why? They have not heard we would welcome them, said Kuntaw. In the old days, women were important. They were the great deciders. They did everything. Some even hunted like men. But over the years, Mi'kmaq men begin to act like white men, who do not regard women as worthy. It is the old Mi'kmaq way to know women are of equal value as men.
Then Aaron spoke of the couple in the ruined village wigwam, the starving people, told what he had found in those wigwams. Those ones in the only unbroken wigwam are named Louis and Sarah Paul.
How old are they? Asked Etienne.
Old, I think, said Aaron.
Peter half stood.
Old? They are not old. Louis is younger than me, a little. I knew that man once. He is a good man for weirs, none so careful as he. We used to call him Eel Man. And a good fisherman. I take him on my boat if he comes here. Very strong. Knows the shoals and currents. He cannot be more than 30 winters. We must go there and get them. Bring them here. tomorrow.
Skerry Halliger, Elise Sell's son, who had gone to Dartmouth College for half a year, had come to Kuntaw's band much as Aaron. They were close in age, but where Aaron was muscular and hard-handed, Skerry was thin and intense, rarely said anything as he felt very much the outsider and was afraid of old Kuntaw, who told him he could never be a real Mi'kmaq man until he killed a moose. He did not think there was much mackerel oil in him. Now, Skerry held out a dirty, creased envelope.
I did not say this before, but my mother, Elise Halliger, wishes to come in summer for a visit. Since my father died, she is alone. She wishes to bring a young woman, Catherine Flute, a full-blood Mi'kmaq girl got brought to Boston by her parents when she was small. The parents are now dead with alcohol sickness, and the girl is unhappy. My mother asks if we will take her here. She is 14 or thereabouts. She says there are other lost Mi'kmaq girls in Boston. We could welcome them here?
Yes, said Etienne in the voice of a hot-blooded moose. Tell your mother to bring all the girls she can find. I will personally marry them all.
2 days later, Aaron, Etienne, Peter, and Alec went back to the path west of Sydney to find the starving Mi'kmaq couple Aaron had seen and bring them to Igdagamkuk.
I am sure this is the place where Lewis and Sarah Paul had that wigwam, said Aaron to the others, as they stood on the trail staring at five white men working with two oxen and a log puller, a dozen more heaping slash into a burning pile. There was no sign of any wigwams, but at the back of the clearing a tiny wisp of smoke caught Etienne's eye.
There, he said,
and they walked over to the flat gray circles of ash. The wigwams had been burned. They saw nothing of Lewis and Sarah Paul.
Ho! Shouted one of the white men. Get out of there! Go on! Get going!
He took up his shotgun, which had been leaning against a log, half-aimed it, and pulled the trigger. A pellet went past Alec's ear with a sound like a hummingbird.
We go! Said Etienne. We go!
This last he shouted angrily, and the same white man did not like his tone and shot again.
Hey!
Said Etienne, hit in the back by a piece of shot.
Those men, said Etienne later as Aaron pried the pellet out of his shoulder. I seen them afore. They not settlers. They come and take any land they can get, clear it, burn it, however they can rid of trees, and sell it. Some settler not want spend his life chopping trees buys it. It's a way white men make money. Take a lot of Kuntaw's oil to make them change.
They walked on toward Sydney.
And do Mi'kmaq not need money now? Asked Aaron. How do you get your money?
Cooperin, said Etienne. Didn't have time to show you yet, but we make barrels. White men buy from us. We got a workshop, forge, oak planks, steamer, plane, everything to make barrels. Big ones, little ones, kegs, casks and tubs. We make the best barrels in Canada. Julian Cooko used to work in a cooper shop in Halifax, showed us how to make barrels, washtubs, all them things. He comes to live with us.
Elise Halliger, widowed and aging, her hair white and stormy, arrived with two girls, Catherine Flute and Marie Antoinette Nevin. Skerry embraced his mother, and it seemed to Aaron that his cousin clung to his mother rather childishly. He would never have survived Bosun Crumble. He smiled at Elise, and when she smiled back, he saw her likeness to Jeannot. He looked at the two girls. Marie Antoinette had a cough and was sometimes distant in her manner, but more often she laughed. She took refuge in laughter and silliness when Elise scolded her for her lazy ways. Marie Antoinette told Catherine Flute that she wanted to go back to Boston. She did not know any plants. Failed to learn how to make baskets or sew, burned anything she tried to cook. She was good company, but that was it. The younger men liked her, and Alec Sell, Peter's son, spent as much time as he could following her around. Aaron saw his youthful self in her behavior. At the end of the summer, before the autumn storms began, Peter, Alec, Aaron, Etienne, and his three boys, Multi, James, and Joe Paul, loaded Peter's boat with barrels to sell in Boston, where they got better prices. They sailed at dawn. Catherine Flute, who shared a wigwam with Elise and Marie Antoinette, said Marie had got up very early. Elise knew at once that the girl had gone on the boat back to Boston, where she would surely take to drink and have a bad end. The men came up the path loaded with bundles and boxes, all the supplies for winter, sacks of potatoes, candles and matches, coffee beans for Elise and Aaron, great tins of tea for the others, needles and bolts of wool and cotton. And there was Marie Antoinette Nevin, red-cheeked and laughing, and coughing. She said, "I am here." She looked at Alec. Catherine Flute, who was shy and plain, a very quiet girl who had been starved and ill-treated by her parents, sat beside Joe Paul. They married before the first snow. Even Elise found herself courted, and she agreed to marry Julian Cucco, the man who had started the men making barrels years earlier, before he had been hurt in a woods accident. Now he had long spells of confusion, and was no good for the barrel shop, but sat by the fire and made eel traps. Kuntaw died on the most beautiful day in 1,000 years. The October air was sweet, and every faint breath a pleasure. Wind stirred, and he said, "Our wind reaching me here." A small cloud formed in the west. "Our small cloud coming to me." The hours passed, and the small cloud formed a dark wall and approached. A drop fell. Another. Many. And Kuntaw said, "Our rain wetting my face." His people came near him, drawing him into their eyes, and he said, "Now, what?" The sun came out. The brilliant world sparkled. Susurration, liquid flow, stems of striped grass. What was it? What was it? The limber swish of a released branch. What? Now what? Kuntaw opened his mouth, said nothing, and let the sunlight enter him. Sixty-one. Talking Stick. Over the next generation, through isolated years of sickness and watchfulness, Kuntaw's people tightened as a clan, although they took in 6 or 7 outsiders. Everyone now had English names, for the old Mi'kmaq names were fading out. Aaron married Liesel Jacko, the only young woman among the newcomers. As a group, they avoided white men, but still fisher, hunter, missionaries found them. Some of these white men only pretended to be hunters. They were scouts on the lookout for timber and ores, anything of economic value. They asked casually to be taken where the big trees grew. "They think we don't know they want to cut them trees down." Their old continuing problem was that Mi'kmaq women rarely came to them. To find wives, the cells had to return to their remnant people at Shubenacadie, thin and listless people who sat staring at the ground. "You see," said one white settler to another, "they are lazy. If they starve, it is because they refuse to work. Do not waste your pity on them. Do not give them food. It only delays the inevitable." When Etienne heard of this, he said, "But they are not lazy, only weak with hunger." A year came when the cells stopped making barrels, for white men had pushed them away from that trade by making cheaper ones, not as tight and sturdy, but at a lower price, and, tellingly, with snowy, curling letters stenciled on the side, "White Ribbon Cooperage." Some who had made barrels began to carve hockey sticks from the dense hardwood of hornbeam trees, whose grooved branches resembled muscular, straining arms. But in a few years, that enterprise, too, passed out of their hands and to a white man manufacturing company. Another womanless cell had drifted to them a few months after Kuntaw died. Edward Outher Cell, the oldest son of Francis Outher, who himself was one of the 2 sons of Beatrix Duquet and Kuntaw, and so a grandson of the ancestor Dutchman Outher Duquet. Edward Outher, who had been subjected to a Duquet education, left Penobscot Bay after his father's funeral, worked a few years in Boston, and then began decades of wandering. By the time he came to his Mi'kmaq relatives, he was in early middle age and rather peculiar. He spoke a garbled, halting, old-fashioned kind of Mi'kmaq language, mixed with unknown jargon and French words. At first, no one knew how he had learned his antique version of the language, and that information he kept to himself for a long time. Every few months, he went away somewhere and came back gray and shaky, sometimes bandaged, but carrying a bag of flour or meal. Little by little it came out. He said that after his father's death he had been a scrivener, a document copyist, in a Boston lawyer's office, hired for his clear, legible hand. But then he was dismissed for tardiness and certain reasons he did not name. "I tell you something now," he said. "The world is very wide. I have traveled much, all the way to the Western Ocean." Slowly, Edward Outher began to talk. He told how skilled horsemen of the Plains tribes were often shot by white men travelers for sport from moving trains as they shot running animals. Dark waves of bison, huge skies stiff with birds. So rich in game were the vast plains that astonishing caravans of lordly hunting parties from Europe and England came with dogs and guns, cooks and special beds and tents. He did sometimes deviate from these sad tales with descriptions of curious adventures, which the Sells preferred to hear. He was only a little strange, and that strangeness fell away. Although his skin was light in color, the shape of his features closely resembled Quintaw's. He said it was because his mother was the daughter of a man who had married a Mi'kmaq woman. "So I am Mi'kmaq person on two sides," he said, laughing, "front and backsides," slapping his crotch and his hindquarters. It was this maternal Mi'kmaq grandmother who had taught him the language which sounded correct from a distance, but was usually incomprehensible. Nor did it take long to discover what Edward Outher did when he went away every few months. He went on a reeling, mindless drunk, and came back very quiet and humble with his penitential bags of flour. His one ability that drew the others to him was storytelling. His tales of what he had seen and done on his travels across the continent to the Pacific. He named some of the West Ocean tribes: Nootka, Kwakiutl, Tlingit, Maka. The Sells liked to hear stories of their West Coast counterparts. As Mi'kmaq had lived on the edge of the Atlantic for thousands of years without intrusive white men, those faraway people had lived on the Pacific. They felt a sense of counterbalance. They listened to Edward Outher's accounts of lives linked to huge cedar trees and the black canoes the Western people made from them, of how they hunted giant whales in those canoes. He told of their communal houses as great buildings with lofty beams, decorated with carved animals and painted visages, and in front of the houses stood immense and gaudily colored poles with the heads of ravens and bears serving as memorials. The men could scarcely believe his stories of how those people split great planks from living trees, how they fashioned boxes by steaming and bending flat boards, never cutting the wood. Edward Outher had one such small bentwood box with him to hold his tobacco, and they passed it from hand to hand, examining it closely. It had a fearsome red face painted on one side that Edward Outher said was an eagle. Once they recognized the eagle, it gave them the feeling of looking into a strange mind. Etienne wanted to know more about how they built the huge houses.
"I wish," said Etienne's wife Ali, "that we could build such a great house, where we could all live safely and in harmony."
Peter spoke.
"And those people on the western coast, do they live free from the incursions of white men?"
Edward Outher hesitated. He understood how badly his relatives wanted to hear of one place in the world where tribal lives continued unspoiled. He sighed.
"Those coast people have known white men for a long time, just as we Mi'kmaq. They traded otter furs to white men for metal to make tools. Then the white men began to catch the otters themselves, and as they always take everything until it is gone, they made the otter very scarce. The people's lives changed.
and now the white men's diseases are burning them up even as we suffered. Sickness comes in their own beautiful canoes on trading trips, for they are great visitors and traders, traveling up and down the coast with goods and to see their friends. The most skillful canoe makers have already died, and many carvers and artists too. In only a few years, they have lost too many of their people to count. They say their world has ceased to exist in a single generation. His listeners knew too well how this was. He changed the subject, and for some time told how these people on the opposite ocean brought down huge trees without axes. Kuntaw's people, most of them cells, drifted back to Subanagadig, now called Shubanakadi, an old Mi'kmaq village location named a reserve in 1820, not because it was better. They went despite the worthless land the white men allowed them, despite the crowding and racist jeering, despite the massacres of the past, the onerous government rules. As Kuntaw had said, they must live in two worlds. They went because inside they carried their old places hidden under the centuries, hidden as beetles under fallen leaves, as pebbles in a closed hand, hidden as memories. They were lonely for their own kind, and for women. There were women there. Beneath the reality of roads and square houses, they saw their old sloping ground, saw their canoes drawn up on shore, pale smoke drifting from wigwams decorated with double curves and pteridoid fronds, chevrons, arched frames, and high color. Yet they could not ignore the reality that wigwams could no longer be made, and that white men settlers had built countless sawmills on the rivers, ruining the best places for eels. Everywhere, to feed the thousand sawmills, countless trees went down. After one St. Anne's Day celebration, some tried to paddle back across the water to Kuntaw's old place, but their canoes were caught in a storm and they perished. There were fewer Mi'kmaq every year, and white men laughed and said with satisfaction that in 40 more years they would be gone, gone like the Beothuk, vanished from the earth. It seemed true. There had never been so few Mi'kmaq since the beginning of time, less than 1,500, the remains of a people who had numbered more than 100,000 in the time before the white men came. Still, the people clung to their home ground, though they wandered often, looking for food, for a haven, for a cleft in the rock that would open into that world that had been torn from them. Etienne spoke seriously and long.
"We got to do something. Our women can make their baskets, but us men got to find wage work for money to buy food. Everybody says, be that white man guide for fishing, but that's not enough." "I'd rather do guide for fish than hunt," said Peter. "They can't hurt you with that fish rod. Only other work for us Mi'kmaq is woods work. Plenty work there."
The white man timber kings were taking down the forests of Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. Hundreds of sawmills stood on every river and stream that could be dammed. Once again, cells took up axes, and although everything was difficult, they continued to talk together, to look for ways out of their troubles. Etienne built a white man log house and named his newest son Joseph Howe Cell to honor the fair-minded commissioner for Indian Affairs. This took some explaining, and in the evenings, the remaining cells gathered in the warmer log house to talk, each bringing a few sticks for the fire. It was a confining, immovable box, but it held the heat better than ragged wigwams made without good bark, tanned skins, or correct poles.
"Joseph Howe is one of them good white men. He looked and he saw our troubles," said Ali, who had shyly suggested the baby's name. "He tried help us. He saw us danger, all us land taken, us push away from river. Can't make eel weirs no more."
"Yes," said Etienne with something like a rare smile. "He saw we was cold, hungry, give us coats, blankets. He said these days we have to give up our wigwam as the bark gone with the big trees. No skin covers, them caribou and moose gone. Plenty logs and planks for a white man house, but we gotta buy them, with white man money," said Peter. He drew his face into a cruel mask. "How is a white man? If he is good to us, it is to get something, more land, something. That is all I got to say about that.
Ali asked a question. Edward Outher, is it better than that Penobscot place where you come from? You got people there? Mi'kmaq already there?
Not anymore. No. Maine people don't like Mi'kmaq people. There are some Mi'kmaq people live there in Aroostook County. Good basket makers. Not just women. Men make those big baskets, too. But Penobscot? Same like here. Woods all gone. White men got the land. My father, Francis Outhersell, had a sawmill. He paused for a murmur of admiration. But after he died in that sawmill, somebody set it afire and burned it all down, and the house. I was alone, family dead, went away out in the west. When I was gone, the town took the property for taxes. My father, he never paid taxes. He thought if you own property, you own it. But you don't own it. You have to pay money every year to that town, or they can take the land. There was a hum of disbelief. They took his land. Well, it was my land then, but I didn't know about the tax. I wasn't there. When I come back, it was all gone, you see. All gone. They laughed at me, said, Indian, you don't own no land here.
Do white men here pay those tax?
I think so. Not know for sure. It is the way of white men that they must pay for everything, not one time, but many, many, many times. We never did this thing with land. Own it, buy it, and pay more tax? Yes. And that is why the Mi'kmaq people now have very little land. The white men get land with papers that secure it. You can see for yourself that now there are 100 times more white men than Mi'kmaq people. If we want to secure any of our old land, we have to do it the white man way with papers and money. To learn those English laws, we have to know how to read, write, in English. The children must learn these ways if they live here, or be wiped out.
No. If we had a canoe full of money, they would not let us own our own land. That is why there is the reserve.
There was muttering, and a father in the back said,
It is true. We are so few in number that they can crush us with ease. One day of shooting and we would all lie dead. It is only a dream that they will some day go back to their old countries. They will never leave our country. They are with us for all time, and if we want to live, we must be like them.
It seems life is better for Indians in the States country.
No, it is not better for us anywhere. But here, near Shubenacadie, I think it is worse. Here the white men hate us very much.
Scary Halliger took the talking stick.
I know how to read and write. I know a little bit about the laws. If I can get books and paper, I can teach the children and anyone who wants to learn this reading and writing. But it takes a long time. It is like learning to hunt.
I, too, can help, said Elise.
Edward Outher cleared his throat and said softly,
And I. But where are all our children? I count only 5.
And he decided that he, too, would marry. It was one thing to talk, quite another to act.
Scary Halliger stood up. His eyes were weary and red.
Also, it is not only that the children must learn reading. Mi'kmaq men must take jobs and be paid.
Jobs? What jobs?
The jobs white men don't want. The hardest jobs. Work in forest to cut trees. Cut firewood for settlers. Carry things for surveyors who mark out ways to take more of our land. Make our hunting paths into roads for white men wagons. Dig potato in Maine. More woods cutting there. We can do this. We can do these things. They will not crush us.
The young men agreed. They would go to the lumber camps and ask for work.
At least in the lumber camps we will eat, said Alec, Peter's son.
You are not going, said Peter. I need you on the boat. Passengers. Fishing.
Etienne's oldest son, Multi, took the stick and said, We can bring money to everyone.
At the end of the evening, someone tossed the stick into the fire. It was only a stick. It was the last talking stick any cell ever held. Talking sticks were the old way. Alex said nothing to Peter but slipped away in the night. In the end, 9 of the younger men went to lumber camps scattered across Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Maine. It was easier for them in the woods camps. Men were valued and measured by what work they could do. And for Edward Outher, that meant increasing Mi'kmaq numbers. He took a young wife, Madil, and did what had to be done. Born in 1877, Lobert Sell was the oldest of Edward Outher's 6 children. Barkskins. For 3 generations, the Sells worked in the woods of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick down into Maine, falling and spudding trees, making booms, cranking booms from headworks, river driving, working the sawmills, building corduroy log roads, cutting cordwood, cutting pulp, cutting pit props. As Europe disgorged its people, the logging camps, especially after the Great War, became polyglot assemblies of men. English, French, Americans, Germans, Swedes, Norwegians, a few men from Greenland, First Nation natives, even 1 or 2 Inuit. Injury and death were common enough in the Northeast woods, but since the first logging days, the most dangerous work was river driving, and until it ended, it was work apportioned to Indians, those considered born to violent water.
"I'll tell you something, mister,"
a camp boss said to a company bookkeeper who had questioned his bateau and grub expenses.
"Company wants its logs? Wants to get them to the sawmill? Water is everything. Water moves the logs, powers the mills. They want their logs in the sawhouse, they better swallow the drive expense, 'cause ain't no other way to get 'em there."
He jerked his thumb at the river where 2 Mi'kmaq and a Montagnais were dancing over the sticks, jabbing them along like sullen sheep. The Sell Barkskins saw the poleaxe give way to the double-bitted axe, the double-bitted axe give way to the crosscut saw, the old up-and-down gang saws give way to circular saws, and double circulars to immensely long steel band saws that could cut the moon in half if they loaded it on a conveyor. Saw the steady oxen give way to smart horses, horses replaced by stinking donkey engines and shea-geared locomotives. As roads punched into forest distant from water, the tumultuous river drives ended in favor of trucks and roads. Loggers began to tend whirling, thumping, boiling, crashing machinery. The Sells suffered accidents and deaths in a profession where a man had to be watchful and lucky to live more than 7 years. The huge trees of the West were hard for puny axemen. It took years to learn how to handle the big stuff, and slow learners did not have time to stay alive. But technology shaped crazy daydreams into real, hissing, screaming machines that leveled the last of the ancient forests on the continent. After the talking stick had been thrown into the fire, the young men left to take up woods work. Etienne Sell and Mike Jacko tried to watch out for their sons, but the boys resented a parental eye and escaped to more distant camps. Mike Jacko's son Blonnie, 15 winters, and his younger brother Polo started on a cutting crew for an outfit in Queens County. Blonnie had an inborn knack for the axe. When he wasn't chopping, Blonnie and a young Swede named Erto peeled bark with spudding irons made of old carriage springs, handled and honed. On his first drive, Blonnie discovered he liked the dodging, leaping river work. He quickly understood the geometries of jams and relished picking them apart. Twice he fell in among the churning logs, but knew better than to fight toward the shore. Better to travel downstream with the sticks. But still, the hateful, cramping reservation was too close, and Blonnie and Polo moved west, worked for a winter in Idaho, where driving on cranky, twisted rivers was still the way to get logs to a sawmill. In the spring, some men in the camp kept going to California, Oregon, Washington, where they said the trees were 300 feet high. A man he only knew as Shirt said to Blonnie,
"Sonny, I'll learn you about them trees. The first Maine logger sailed up the coast and come near the shore seen a solid wooden wall 100 mile long with green stuff up around the clouds. Couldn't believe what he seen. Fell down in a fit. He couldn't believe it. Nobody could believe it. But it was true.
and that's where I'm going.
Blonnie and Polo were frightened the first time they saw the donkey engine at work. The engine was lashed to several stout trees and its steel haul cable lying loose and quiet on the ground. Five men stood casually around the engine. A signal came from somewhere distant, and the puncher threw his lever. The donkey engine came to life. They watched the cable drum turn and the cable itself begin to wind on, tightening and tightening. The engine roared louder, and there was a distant snapping of branches, a few faraway shouts, and in minutes, the crackling and ground-shaking thumps grew louder, and then out of the slash came a monstrous 30-foot log springing into the air like a decapitated chicken in its final manic leaps, smashing down on stumps so hard they splintered, rebounding and coming straight for the donkey engine.
"Holy Jesus!"
yelled Blonnie to the delight of the puncher. The two greenhorns ran for their lives, followed by the haw-haws of the donkey crew. They looked back. The terrible log rested quietly a few feet short of the donkey engine. Polo never imagined that a few months later he would be assigned as one of the steam kettle's crew, and that an hour after he began work, ignorantly standing near a lazy curve in the cable already fastened to a faraway log, his left foot would be amputated by the tautened wire minutes after the engineer hit the lever with the heel of his calloused hand. His brother Blonnie and the engineer carried him spouting blood down to the bunkhouse. The second cook, Andre Mallet, served the camp as medic. He rested Polo's leg on a junk of wood to elevate it, bound the bleeding stump above the ankle with a clean dish towel soaked in melted lard, gave Polo copious amounts of his medicinal whiskey for the pain, and said he'd look in after the dinner hour. He sent Blonnie back with a cup of hot partridge broth and half a whiskey-soaked cake. This, in addition to certain Mi'kmaq sedatives, crinkle root and lady's slipper root, that their mother had given Blonnie just in case, and the shock, shut Polo down like a dry oil lamp. He slept. There followed weeks of pain and whiskey, but slowly he began to heal.
"You stay here until you get around, but then I need your bunk for a working man," the boss said.
One of the choppers whittled out a pair of crutches. He was moving around the bunkhouse when Andre Mallet came in.
"Hey, kid, boss cook cleared it so's you can help in the kitchen."
What could he do but say yes? After a year, he could scuttle around wearing a logger-whittled prosthesis. He was becoming a cook, and some kind of permanent job might be there. But then Blonnie's death hit hard, and he was the one who had to write the letter home. Blonnie had wanted to be a river driver, but water work in Washington was salty, herding and corralling logs in tidewater. Because he was young, he was a choker setter, the lowest job in the camp. After a few weeks in the high-lead logging camp, he discovered a job even more daring than river work. He watched Napoleon Tessier, a skinny little Frenchman wearing climbing spurs and laden with saw, axe, and rope, rush 10 or 12 feet up the trunk of a big Douglas fir, dig in and casually flip his climbing loop to a higher position, scampered on again toward the top of a 200-foot-tall tree. As he climbed, he cut the limbs as flush as possible with his long-handled, double-bitted axe, finally stopped 30 feet below the leader. His rope secure around the naked trunk and himself, his spurs jammed deep, he axed off the top, as large as a second-growth Maine pine. It tipped down with a crack and hiss, the wind rushing through the needles of the falling section. The bare spar, with Tessier hanging on, whipped back and forth. Tessier let out a screech and waved one arm like a wild horse rider. Then he slid and kicked down so swiftly he blurred. On the ground, he took a swig of cold tea, ate a handful of sugar, and went back up to rig the pulley block, for Tessier was a rigger as well as climber. When the job was done and the pulley block and guy lines in place, they were ready to move giants. Blonnie wanted to do this, to become a climber. He begged the boss to let him try. This man, a big, perfect Swede with a mouth full of tobacco, did not like Blonnie or Polo because they were East Coasters as well as half-breeds.
But Blonnie kept asking, and finally Tessier said aloud that he ought to let the kid try. Climbers were not plentiful, and finally the boss said,
"Go ahead, Pocahontas."
Blonnie put on Tessier's spurs, buckled on the belt, tied his axe to it, got the climbing rope around the tree and himself, stuck his spurs into wood, and tried to move up as Tessier had, to flip the loop up as Tessier had. Higher and higher, jamming in, flipping the rope, and he reached the first branches. Tessier, who was coaching, called up,
"Don't cut your rope!"
Men had been known to make a quick misplaced slash and cut their own loop, a one-time-only mistake. Blonnie kept on, strong, quick blows, paying no attention to the feathery, scratching branch tips. Up again, flip, chop, continue.
"High enough!" yelled Tessier. "Top it!"
Blonnie topped it. The swinging ride as the limber spar swiped back and forth was the reward. He could see the distant ocean. He was above the world.
"Très bien! Done pretty good for a first climb," said Tessier. "Slow, but you done good."
Blonnie couldn't get enough spar tree climbing, and the more he did, the faster he moved, trying to beat Tessier, who lately had struck a pose standing atop the fresh-trimmed spar while it was still quivering. So Blonnie had a stunt in mind as he climbed his last tree. Up he went, as squirrel-like as Tessier, and about to do a trick that would show up the mustachioed Frenchman. He planned to top his tree, lift himself on top, stand on his head, and whistle. But as the heavy branched top he had just cut hinged over, the spar split and caught Blonnie in the cleft as a clothespin grips a tea towel. His scream was short, the air squeezed out of his collapsed lungs. It was Tessier's dreadful job to climb up and cut the spar a second time, this time below the dead boy, whose urine-drenched boots dangled in his face. Blonnie fell, still in the clasp of the Douglas fir, and they buried him that way. Etienne's son Multicell, his cousin Alex Cell, and the two Mias brothers, Noel and John, worked from Oregon to the Queen Charlotte Islands. Nimble and limber as they were, after Blonnie's death, no one wanted to climb and rig tall trees. Multi stayed a choker setter for 5 or 6 seasons, his hands as hardened as lobster claws from gripping and heaving heavy chains. He was used to chains, didn't mind the weight. He signed on to work with Flannel Logging, a small gypo outfit owned by Robbie and Glenn Flannel, but only a few miles from a bobtail town offering some of the pleasures of life. It was a bad crew. In his second week of work, the three other choker setters stole the gypo's chains and left in the night. Robbie Flannel drove his ailing log truck down the mountain to set the sheriff on the trail and to buy new chains. When he came back, he had no chains, but cheaper coils of cable and used haywire, and 2 old drunks from the bar who were the replacement choker setters.
"Cable lighter to use, easier to get it under a log," said Glenn. "Use the haywire to move the cable. Forget about chains. Multi, you show these 2 stiffs what to do. They ain't no good, but they're alive, and anybody can be a choker setter, right?"
Multi knew he should have walked off the job right then, but he didn't. They attached the haywire to the skyline cable, and the donkey pulled it uphill. Someone released the haywire, and one of the downslope stiffs fumbled with the excess. Multi fastened the haywire to another cable that had to be moved. He gave the signal to the